Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hundreds of thousands of foreclosures frozen today in all 50 states. It's the latest bombshell to hit America's messy, vital housing market. It may mean a temporary reprieve for families and homeowners just holding on. It also threatens to freeze fear, uncertainty, and home sales, and maybe the broader economy. This hour On Point, real estate, homes, and what comes next for American housing and the economy. You can join the conversation. Are you trying to sell, to buy, to dodge the bank? What do you see going on out there with homes, real estate? Is it turning around, finding bottom, freezing up? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Diana Olick, real estate reporter for CNBC. Her blog for the network is Realty Check. Diana, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Tom.
What is going on right now with this big freeze, at least the beginning of a big freeze in foreclosure?
Well, what we're hearing now is that at least 40 state attorneys general will be announcing at some point, potentially tomorrow, an investigation that would be led by Iowa's state attorney general into possible fraud on the big banks and the foreclosure process. But until then, what we're seeing now on the street is a whole lot of buyers who are being really stalled in their purchases of foreclosed properties.
Because nobody knows what's going to happen. Take us back just for a second. What went off the rails here with foreclosure? What has got the Attorney General so upset?
Well, the banks will tell you that it was sheer volume. It really depends on who you're talking to in this entire mess. The volume of foreclosures coming into the pipeline in these banks was just so much that the banks were basically using one person, or allegedly using one person, to sign many, many documents.
10,000 a month, I've seen one number quoted.
Right, and we've already heard from various employees of the big banks that some have said that they were just sitting there signing documents all day. Now, what that has done is made people look further into the process, and now there are allegations of fraud, not just in signing, but, of course, into who actually owns these loans. As you remember, at the height of the housing market, the securitization, that is, the bundling of these loans and selling mm-hmm. them off into the private markets where they were traded among many different investors, left a paper trail that was very difficult to follow. That means that a lot of these loans, the banks don't even know, or they haven't been able to say exactly who owns the loans. And if you don't know who owns the loans, then courts will say that you can't foreclose on that property. There is something called MERS, which is this huge database of properties, of titles, that was used in order by the big banks in the securitization process to kind of park these loans in one central place. But now the validity of MERS is being questioned, and whether or not they own the loans or they hold the loans or who are the investors. And it's all just spiraled out of control into allegations of fraud at all the major lenders.
Everybody is on this now and wondering what it means for housing and homes and real estate and the whole economy. Here's Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida. Of course, they've been hard hit by foreclosures. I'm sure her constituents probably have. This is on Fox News Sunday, saying she supports a moratorium on foreclosures.
We need a combination of a freeze, potentially, and also we need to sit down with the banking industry and talk to them about ways in which we can help them be able to work those mortgages out, because it's absolutely imperative that we keep people in their homes.
Sit down and talk with the banking industry. The banking industry must wonder what comes next here. Here's Eric Cantor, Republican of Virginia, saying he fears that a foreclosure freeze could hurt the already struggling housing market.
If you impose a moratorium on foreclosures, what you're telling people and institutions that lend money is they do not have the protection to take the risk they need to extend credit so people can get a mortgage.
And hear the voice of the White House, maybe Presidential Advisor David Axelrod, kind of splitting the difference. This is on CBS Sunday. Axelrod saying he doubted the need for a national moratorium on all foreclosures.
I'm not sure about a national moratorium because there are, in fact, valid foreclosures that probably should go forward.
Diana Olick, we're going to look at ramifications here, but what's the political game that's going on? Is there one?
Well, obviously, every politician is getting in on this because we have elections coming up, and they know that their constituents, many of them, are the ones who are in trouble, who are facing foreclosures, and none of them like the big banks. The problem is you have to see what it's doing to the greater housing market in general. I mean, we spoke to a woman in Miami who was about to close on a condo, and she had the money down, had the contract written, and then was told by Bank of America, well, it's going to be anywhere from 15 to 90 days until we can tell you if this is going to happen. Now, her agent, her real estate agent, is saying, well, maybe we're just going to pull out of the deal entirely. Fannie Mae is refunding down payments for their they have a program where they give incentives for people buying foreclosed properties because they have such a huge inventory. So the problem then is you have this huge glut of foreclosed properties that need to be bought by people who can afford them. On the other side, you have politicians saying, look, we've got to figure out whether there was real fraud at the big banks. I mean, I spoke to one analyst who said, look, yes, probably the bulk of these homeowners were not paying their mortgages and deserve to be foreclosed on. But even he likened it to even when you're a criminal on trial, you have a right to a fair trial. And what they're saying is the banks have not given these folks a fair trial by not doing the proper paperwork.
They were so into moving the volume and into the bundling. I mean, worst case scenario here, leaving aside individual homeowners for a minute, and of course each of them lives in their own world and can really feel up against it. But I mean, I've even seen people saying that this could be such a hit to the banks, we might be facing another TARP, another like TARP 2 bailout.
Yeah, I've heard that from one analyst, Janet Tavakoli of Tavakoli Structured Finance, that we could be looking at TARP 2 if you have all kinds of lawsuits against these banks, and they're looking, you know, they're going to have to, if they see, we've already seen a possible class actions, the Ohio State Attorney General issuing a class action suit. So the question is, how much is this going to cost the banks in the end, and are they going to need more money from the government in the end? And then it just becomes a spiral, and that's why you have this political hot potato sitting there. I mean, you've got the administration stuck in the middle. They've already spent billions of dollars bailing out the banks and the housing market on both sides.
Okay, so we've got a lot of sales lately have been foreclosures, at least until now, maybe a third of what's being sold foreclosures. What about the broader market? What's the impact for homes not in foreclosure, just, you know, on the market or would be on the market, Diana?
Exactly. About one quarter of all homes sold in August were foreclosures, and one third of all homes were distressed properties. That is short sales and foreclosures. Short sales are when you make a deal with the bank to sell the property for less than the value of the mortgage. So there you have a huge chunk of the housing market. Now, some would argue that if you take foreclosures out of the picture, you could actually put a bottom on home prices temporarily because you don't have these low-priced foreclosures competing with your organic sales. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, these foreclosures at some point are going to have to go through the system because you can't just live in your home rent-free. And if you're not paying your mortgage, and Bank of America says on average the people they foreclose on have not made a mortgage payment in 18 months.
Wow.
So at some point, these folks are going to have to be, you know, processed through the system. So is it a temporary help to the housing market for a couple of months while the banks work through this, or maybe it's 6 months? Possibly it steadies home prices briefly. But then again, you have an awful lot of people very concerned, and it's not like there was a lot of confidence in the housing market in the first place. So now you have people, just regular buyers, even more concerned about what is going on. They hear about all these foreclosure scandals and the robo-signing, and maybe they just say, you know what, I'm going to wait this out until everything seems to at least have some kind of answer to it all. And so then there's a question of, does that hurt demand? Does it help prices? You could make the argument on either side. One thing we do know is that at some point, if these folks are not paying a mortgage, they are going to be processed, and those homes will eventually have to come out onto the market again at these lower distress prices.
Diana Olick is real estate reporter for CNBC. Her blog is Realty Check. Diana, you're terrific. You've got us all teed up to dive in. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Joining me right now in the studio is Carl Case, Chip Case, Professor Emeritus of Economics at Wellesley College. He is co-creator with Robert Shiller of Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Housing Index. Everybody knows it. Everybody follows it. Carl Case, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
What do you see going on? A couple of months ago, you were sounding kind of optimistic about maybe beginning to find some kind of bottom. I don't know, but where are we now?
Well, the market didn't need this. I mean, it really has created a lot of uncertainty. I would say there's more separation between the auction market and the rest of the market than Diana seems to think there is.
The foreclosure auction market, yeah, and everything else, really? They can live in two different worlds?
Well, they obviously have an influence on each other, and this uncertainty takes demand out of the entire market. But no units are actually being created or destroyed. It's not affecting the total potential demand or the total potential supply. It's just it's putting it on hold. And the price, how prices are going to respond to this depends on where you are. If you think of if you look at those million mm-hmm. sales, mm-hmm. more than half
which million sales, Jeff?
Well, Diana referred to a quarter of all the units. So we're selling about 4 million existing homes
per
year.
Okay.
And so if you put that in and you look at the auctions are running at about a million.
Okay, so
it's
about a quarter of everything sold is foreclosures at the moment, or
right.
has been.
And if you look at that the million sales, it's concentrated in four or five states. Mm-hmm. So it's California, Florida, Arizona, and Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the market is physically separated in some cases,
and by mountains and deserts and miles.
Yeah, and housing's a very different market than other markets. It you can't move the stuff. It's where it is. It's created a slowdown in mobility, in fact.
But it's not only in those places. I mean, over time, Diana says you've got to clear these distressed properties, and that's a brutal phrase for people living in them, I know, but you've got to clear them for the whole market to recover, whatever that means.
Well, you look at the whole market, you get even a bigger and more complex picture. The whole market is what's the stock of housing and how many units do we need? How many units are likely to be demanded over time?
Mm-hmm.
When you look out in the long run, there has to be a balance between housing production and new households. If you look at the analyses that have been done over the past 10
sure.
or 15 years, back
people
to
have
Mankiw
to live somewhere.
Right. They look at housing starts and housing new households. And right now, that's the biggest worry, I think. I think this will take care of itself. The market comes into these situations where there's imbalances and deals with it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American housing, real estate, prices, foreclosure scandal, and what comes next for housing and the U.S. economy. Carl Case is with us, Chip Case. He's co-creator with Robert Shiller of the Case Shiller, the Standard & Poor's Case Shiller Housing Index. With us right now as well from New York, Ivy Zelman, CEO of Zelman and Associates. It's a consulting group focuses on the housing industry. Ivy Zelman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What's on the table with this new, Bank of America frozen in all 50 states now. Other big banks, GMAC now, Ally, and Chase, also big problems and more. What's at stake here, Ivy?
Well, I think if it was just the technicality of loans not being properly processed with signatures, it would be a very quick issue. We'd probably have, within weeks, the signatures done accurately, and we could move on, and it would be relatively minimal cost to the banking industry. However, because of the comments Diana was making regarding the attorney generals that are jumping on board, politically maneuvering whatsoever, we could morph into something much bigger, much grander, and could be much more costly and more negative to the housing market and especially to the lenders and servicers. It's really spiraled out of control, and I wonder how much is political grandstanding, and maybe some of this will die out after the election is behind us. But just the fact that lenders are being accused with the word fraud, I find it to be quite amusing, considering that word in context, technically by the letter of the law, might be correct. But files were processed, law firms made sure that the loans were complete or the files were complete with documents, and then the files were sent back to a quality assurance departments, which would button down the file, and then that file went on to a third party within the bank, and that third party signed it, but it wasn't the person in the quality assurance department that signed it. So that's the quote-unquote fraud. But what's not being discussed, Tom, is that person hasn't paid their mortgage in sometimes as much as 2 years.
Right.
So what about that person? What about their fraud?
Well, right. There's two sides to this. But, our listeners are paying close attention here, Ivy. Here's Darren. He says foreclosure is not only crucial, it's necessary for a healthy housing market to get back to one. But here's another listener who says, I don't have a problem with foreclosures per se. I have a huge problem, he writes, with banks. Once again, just doing it however. If the banks kind of got off the rails in how this is supposed to be done, are they now once again holding the country hostage to fast and loose big-time banking, Ivy?
You know, I think it's blown out of proportion. I think that, you know, recognizing the banks need to technically do all files of processing correctly on these foreclosure files, I think that realistically you do have to clear the market. There are people that bought homes that didn't have the incomes to support them. There are people that lied about their incomes. There are people that just strategically decided to stop paying their homes because they were so far underwater. And there are buyers for these assets. And when you have assets that are priced appropriately, they clear. They get purchased. And if you actually arrest that process, you only further delay the housing recovery. And in order for housing to resume sort of a normal cycle, where we have home price appreciation, which is typical in an annual range of, call it, 3 to 4% per annum, right now it's going to govern any hopes of us getting back to some normalcy in the housing market if we arrest the process.
Carl Case, Chip Case, I saw Mark Zandi, economy.com, saying maybe the housing market would be back into, what, the third quarter 2014 or something like that, he was saying, and now he's saying with this big rock in the pond, it could be years.
It really could be. There's some big worries in the market, but it's too bad because it was really coming back. It may have been the credit, it may not have been the credit, but prices were actually rising in the last 18 months. They started doing. California's done very well. And all of a sudden, this and the expiration of the credit almost coinciding is going to throw a real wrinkle into things.
What do you see coming at this point? Because this is all tied in with the U.S. economy. They kind of are hand in glove here. It may not be housing-based again, but it's hard to get it going without housing in some decent health.
Well, there's two big negatives and one big positive. The two big negatives are the demographics. We're not building any. We're at 50-year lows. The fact that we're not building any should mean that the market tightens up as we get more mm-hmm. households. But the households seem to be disappearing. So the demand.
What does that mean? I mean,
well,
aren't we still here?
Kids are doubling up. Immigrants aren't coming. We're not treating them well. When they get here, they can't get jobs. Many are going home. So we have projections of 1 million households that we may not have. And so that's leading to higher vacancy, even though we're not building anything. That's a big, big worry.
Ivy, do you see that as a log across the tracks here? If immigration slows down, if kids just keep, you know, bunking up with their parents, we've also seen the figures on young Americans not getting married in the same numbers. Is it possible that we won't have the household creation to make the demand happen?
Well, I think that right now it certainly, I would agree with Chip with respect to the demand being as sluggish as it is, a lot of it because of people doubling up or parents moving in back with children and roommates as opposed to single-head households. But I think that part of that, if the job market actually shows any momentum, we will have, you know, the 28-year-old will leave mom and dad and probably go get an apartment or go maybe even buy a home. So I do think that a lot of it is from the deep weakness in the overall economy, and we could see a resumption in household growth. But right now it's clearly well below any expectations that we've seen for resumption in it.
Chip Case?
The other thing on the positive side that's been driving the market is if you think about housing as a consumer durable good,
mm-hmm.
I mean, its price has gone down a lot. I mean, prices are down on average 30%. The mortgage rate is 4.1 or 4.2%. So kids getting out and looking at housing now as a purchase option for the first time in 6 or 7 years are finding it really within their reach, and I'm not talking about the auction markets.
But what really matters here is, isn't it, this sort of ratio between income and the cost of housing?
But
how's that look?
That looks terrific. If you look at that back over the last about 5, 6, 7 years,
mm-hmm.
we're back to the same levels of household to income ratio, house price to income ratio that we were at before this whole thing began.
Ivy, do you see it that way?
I agree on the surface. The numbers look very compelling, and it looks as if we've seen a very affordable market that's come to fruition as a result of the deflation. What's unfortunate is that by itself, it doesn't really tell the whole picture. People have very significant debt on their balance sheets. They don't have the down payment to come up with. They have very weak credit scores, which is really maybe a function of the economic downturn. But what we have unfortunately seen is many people can't come up with the down payment. And if it wasn't for FHA, which is the government loans available to only put 3.5% down to purchase a home in the United States and still have only, therefore, a very, very high loan-to-value loan, which accounts for almost 50%, Tom, of all the purchases in the United States. So people are, without that, this market would be 10 times worse than it is today. So when it comes to putting 20% down, people don't have that type of down payment. And I think, therefore, the affordability ratios, although very positive, they don't tell the whole story.
Let's go to Webb, Iowa. We've got a lot of callers here. First to Kim. Kim, hi, you're on the air.
Well, hello.
Hi, Kim. What do you know?
Well, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
And that is, I know in these troubled states, such as Arizona, Nevada, California, Florida, that a huge number of the loans, and I'm not sure what that percentage is, were people that were purely speculating, that were planning on turning these homes because of the rapid appreciation.
Right, buy and flip, yeah.
And that caused a huge amount of the glut. Now, I'm wondering if the lending institutions or the people that own the paper are making a differentiation on foreclosure proceedings relative to the people that were purely speculating or the people that are actually living in a home and in the residence?
It's an interesting question. Ivy, I don't know if you know. I mean, right now, sure, for a bunch of banks, for some banks, everything's frozen, or a lot is frozen. But when they were they foreclosing on all homeowners the same, speculator or live-in?
Well, I think, you know, we have to recognize that there has been, since February of 2009, the Obama administration announced a program to help troubled borrowers, to keep them in their homes, called the Home Affordability Modification Program.
Right.
And really it tries to distinguish in that program only for those people that are truly in hardship, that are troubled, as opposed to the speculator. So that program was only geared to those people in trouble. And there's also been incremental initiatives, something called the Hardest Hit Fund, which is for states where people are living in their homes, unfortunately, and are unemployed, that they can actually have the government make the payment for them until they find a job. And those programs are specific to those people, again, that are truly in hardship. So they do distinguish in terms of programs to help borrowers that are truly in hardship and that could actually have mortgages that are modified to meet their either lower income levels or they have too much debt, and they're trying to help those people where they can. Unfortunately, if you ask lenders, and this is just crazy, but they reach out to, let's say, 100 people that haven't paid their mortgage to say, hey, we want to help you, borrower. And in some cases, they have about only 30 to 40% of those people ever respond back to them. So I think their lack of responses would indicate they've already moved on, or they know they lied about their income, or to your point, maybe they were speculators. But when they are truly in need of help, sometimes they don't know that they can get help. So the borrower, or should I say the lender, continues to attempt to find that borrower and to give them the program that might best fit them. So it's really been, on both sides, a lack of response or working together to make sure the program fits the appropriate borrower.
I mean, we hear these horror stories of people who really want to work something out with the banks going round and round and round for, you know, a year or more and just can't get it done. Paducah, Kentucky, Connie is calling. Hi, Connie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you today?
Pretty well. What do you know, Connie?
Actually, I know a couple of different things. One, I come at this particular discussion from two different directions. One, I'm an executive director for a Habitat for Humanity affiliate, so I do
bless
have
you
a kind of interesting perspective on housing and housing for lower-income families and building.
Yeah.
But then also, I am someone who lost their home in foreclosure.
Oh, boy.
And through the loss of the job. And I do have to admit that listening to the woman speaking about, you know, trying to get back into that market through no fault of your own and trying to find a lender who's willing to work with you. Unfortunately, I wasn't one of the fortunate few that could get a hold of someone who was willing to work with me, because
yeah,
I would have dearly loved to have stayed in my house.
Right.
I couldn't get hold of someone who would either return my phone calls or would follow through. And I realized that some of it was just sheer volume. I know that those folks that were working had to have just been inundated, but it was very frustrating.
Absolutely.
I would have done anything to have stayed in my house.
What are you going to do now, Connie? Are you thinking, are you still trying to buy to find a bargain? Are you going to be a renter? What's your plan? What's your hope?
Actually, I'm a, believe it or not, according to the federal government, because I live with my sister, I'm a homeless person. Isn't that ironic?
And you're building Habitat for Humanity. Oh, man. Oh, man.
But the good news is that I'm blessed. I have a roof over my head. I have a job, you know, we are rebuilding. But I think the two takeaways from this particular conversation are, one, you know, you do need to find somebody sympathetic who is willing to take up the mantle and say, yes, we are willing to work with you. And if you can find someone who is willing to do that. And then the second is, you know, then you just need to, if the worst case scenario happens and you do go into foreclosure, then just, you know, suck it up, cut your costs, and build up your credit and your down payment so you can get back out there and get back in the market. The other issue is that has anyone really addressed the question of what's going to happen as the boomers continue to age and there's not a population behind it to take up some of this housing slack as well, or is that even an issue?
Well, let us look at that, Connie. You've got a great attitude, and bless you for Habitat for Humanity work. We hope that you end up in a not officially homeless state real soon. I'm sure you will. Chip Case, what about this? Connie takes us back to demographics. You know, the boomers, a bunch of them presumably at some point here are going to want to sell their homes.
Greg Mankiw a few years ago wrote a beautiful paper called The Baby Boom, The Baby Bust in the Housing Market. And when he forecast that the housing market would crash in the 1990s, it didn't. It did very well. One of the reasons was when we got the results of the 1990 census, we had 10 million people we didn't know we had. My worry this time is that with the baby boomers now actually getting very close to retirement, mm-hmm. We may discover it when we tabulate the 2000 census or the 2010 census that we have 5 million fewer people than we thought we had.
What does that mean for a boomer sitting not in one of the four crisis states you're talking about, but sitting in some market that seems like it's doing pretty well? Dallas has done pretty well. Is there still a cliff waiting for those people if they haven't really been bitten in this downturn?
Well,
a demographic cliff or not?
Again, you have to look at the local markets.
Mm-hmm.
But one important point about that is it takes a small number of people to move the market. If you look at the number of transactions that we look at, mm-hmm. when we calculate what's happening to prices, mm-hmm. it's about 5% of the stock, or maybe even less than that.
Right.
We sell about 4 million a year. The stock's about 130 million.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the number of people who have to change their view or get access to credit or want to move, it's not a lot to move the market because the market is driven by the traders.
Ivy, what about this idea? Glenn Hubbard, who was George W. Bush's economic advisor, put it out there that Fannie Mae sort of refinance just about everybody who's got a home mortgage now at a lower rate. These current rates, which are so low, would cut people's monthly payments all over the place, maybe put cash in people's pockets for the general economy and get the housing market back in gear. Does that have traction?
Actually, it's funny that that is talked about because, ironically, you know what would happen? It would arrest housing turnover because as we think about the 130 million dwellings in the United States and roughly 76 million actually own a home, and, you know, assuming you have 4 million that are trading, people that actually get refinanced into a low coupon, assuming that were to come to fruition,
right.
they wouldn't have to move. So you would actually slow down housing turnover and magnify the problem of weak housing.
But if you don't slow it down, you're going to have all this foreclosure stuff going on. Isn't that overhang a problem as well? All those, still millions, right? People are projecting will go into foreclosure?
Well, actually, the program that they're trying to provide is not for people that are in default. It's for all borrowers, even those
right.
that are current.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to mitigate strategic defaults by assumingly having already the risk on the balance sheet of the U.S. government through the GSEs. If we give everyone who's current a lower coupon, then, in fact, they will keep paying and they won't strategically default. But there's lots of consequences to that, especially for banks that own mortgages at par, and I might have a coupon that's paying 6%. Now, all of a sudden, the banks are only going to get a 4% coupon. I mean, the losses associated for the banks would be significant, not to mention the secondary mortgage market, that it would accelerate prepayment speeds, which would put a lot of pressure on the cost for those mortgage investors.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American housing, real estate prices, foreclosure scandal now, and what comes next for housing and the economy. We've been joined by Ivy Zelman, CEO of Zelman & Associates out of New York. Carl Case, Chip Case, is co-director with Robert Schiller of Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Housing Index. He's with me in the studio. And joining us right now is Alan Sinai, founder and chief global economist and president of Decision Economics. Alan Sinai, welcome back to On Point. What do you see coming in housing, sir?
Not very much. Consumers, they don't want to buy big ticket items. That's cars and houses. They're income constrained, they're credit constrained. And I think American consumers are saving a lot more, spending a lot less. The big ticket items are too expensive, and they're spending their money other ways. I think it's a permanent phenomenon. It's going to last several more years. So the outlook for housing, home sales, new and existing housing starts, the builder community, the financing of it is really, I would say, negative.
What does that mean, then, for the overall economy? I mean, there's a kind of a, is it a sort of teeter-totter relationship here? Can housing get going without the big economy get going? What about the other way around? Can the big general economy get going without housing, Alan?
In the big economy, in GDP terms, real GDP terms, mm-hmm. Real residential construction, which is the component of real GDP that relates to home sales, housing, although there's a lot of components of consumption that relate to it, is less than 3% of real GDP, and 10 years ago it was 6% of real GDP. State and local government spending is almost 12% of real GDP, and exports are 11.5% of real GDP.
Okay.
So those numbers tell you the answer. It's not a big deal anymore.
Wow, amazing. I mean, there was a time when we all had the idea that it was at the heart of the American economy. Was that always an illusion?
No, when it's 6% of real GDP and goes up a lot in recovery and goes down a lot in recessions, it has a big effect on the business cycle. But I don't think that's the case anymore. Now, there are derivative effects. There's a lot of consumer spending that relates to housing-related, and those are going to be soft, too, except for, you know, the stuff people do around their homes to keep their homes. It's a huge seismic shift in the psychology, the behavior, the economic fundamentals around the consumer. We're already, in our research, in the fifth year of it. And then there's a psychological element, and mm-hmm. that is, it's a lousy asset now. You know, you can't buy a house and expect the price to go up, and you can't use the house because you don't have enough equity in it after the big 30, I think in the Case-Shiller. Carl will correct me on this, approximately 30% decline peak to trough in housing prices, never before seen post-World War II at all. That's a huge decline in that asset. It's kind of a pariah as an investment, as a speculation. And when you take that out, mm-hmm. I think you take out a lot of the huge demand for homes and housing that we saw in the last decade or two.
Let me put that to my other guest, if you would, Alan Sinai. Chip Case, Carl Case, first. It's a lousy asset now, says our big economist. What do
you
say?
Well, if you get people back to the days of thinking of housing as a consumer durable good, then the appreciation depreciation is an add-on to the yield, but the basic yield comes from living in it. I mean, you don't worry about your car going down in value. You invest
you know
in it,
it
over
will.
A period of time,
mm-hmm.
and it, driving it gives you transportation services that you need. And
still,
so
that's
yield.
Such a giant shift in psychology that people may just put the whole thing into a psychological, into the negative column.
I think the housing market is always more psychological because it's a very big asset. It's in some cases many times income when you lay out to buy a home.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't ignore the capital gain. But thinking of the house as a consumer durable good and highlighting the yield that comes in the form of housing services, living in the house, it's not a bad investment at today's prices.
Ivy, what do you think about this? Alan Sinai's characterization of housing as a lousy asset now.
Well, I think from a primary occupant, I would agree there's definitely that sentiment for people today. But on the other hand, I did a piece of research about a year ago. We called it Investors Gone Wild Part 2. Because what we had been seeing really with the beginnings of the recovery that Carl spoke about in the housing market mm-hmm. was a tremendous bid by investors buying REO that was traded or priced at what they believed to be below replacement cost.
REO, bank-owned real estate.
Yeah, bank-owned, sorry, real estate mm-hmm. foreclosure. And if you went into a market like Phoenix, Arizona, or in Nevada and Las Vegas, you could buy homes that might be down as much as from the original value, 60-70%. Mm-hmm. So there was a significant number of people coming off of buses to buy up foreclosures,
yeah.
and those also bidding on the courthouse steps. It used to be only about 5%+ of properties on the courthouse steps would go to third parties, and in places in parts of California, that's up to 15-20%. So there is a tremendous interest in buying real estate still, but it has to be at the right price, which is what I said earlier about a clearing price.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of these investors, some of them are either buying them in hopes of renting them out and getting a rental yield and eventually flipping them and then making their real big bucks, or others are individuals, mom and pops, that are buying these to live in because they're a great deal. So I think at the right price, people actually are very enthusiastic about residential real estate and may not have that negative, this is a lousy asset feeling. But those that are stuck in a house that live in some of these states that are at or below the loan amount, they're certainly not very anxious about their ability to get out of this asset and move into a bigger house or have any interest
in
maybe taking on more debt.
Right. How would they? Alan Sinai, what do you make of it was Glenn Hubbard's and his partner, what, Mayor Meyer, proposing that Fannie Mae just knock down interest rates kind of across the board for mortgage holders as a way of loosening things up, putting some change back in people's pockets, and maybe, you know, clearing some of the books with repricing of the banks who've got trillions of bad debt here. Economically, how would that play out, Alan?
Well, it's got elements of good ideas, a lot of good ideas out there, but the system is not coming to a conclusion on that because the lenders who have these assets in the books don't want to write them down, and nobody's putting up the money to subsidize their writing it down. And of course, the people underwater are really in a great deal of trouble, and they need to have lower interest rates. That's the wisdom of the idea of
mm-hmm.
Glenn and Chris on that. The and we're kind of stuck here, and we also have a problem in that the government owns now the lenders, essentially owns the lender, and the government now owns the mortgage finance market. That's not viable. We all know that in the financial reform regulation, the Dodd-Frank bill, we punted on that issue. And there's another issue which will have to do with tax reform as to whether the subsidy that we've provided to the homeowner, the American dream, whether that will even stay under the problems associated with big budget deficits and tremendous tax benefit and lost revenues to the government of that. So with all that stuff to work through, plus
mm-hmm.
the overhang of deteriorated financial conditions for consumers, I guess I'm just one of those hard-headed buyers. Yeah, I'll go out there and buy, if I want a house, the way Carl's described it.
To live in.
Good old tried-and-true reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's a provider of services. You live in it for that purpose and nothing more. And you've got to be able to afford it. Shouldn't take any chances on it.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I'm going to look for lower prices at some point if I want to look for bargains. As an investment, though, and that was a big part of the rise in home prices.
Of course.
And the tremendous sales that we saw. I don't think anybody's quantified how big a part it was, but the Hertz psychology really went to work on that one. It was the most highly leveraged asset, perhaps, in the history of the United States, both from the borrower and lender side and in the financial institution side. And when that residential real estate collapsed and prices collapsed, the whole ball of wax of a domino of cards came tumbling down. You and I talked about it, Tom.
Sure. I'm going to ask you what might bring us back if housing won't, Alan, but we've got a lot of callers. Amy, Lexington, Kentucky. Amy, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Amy. Good. What do you know?
Well, I heard you commenting earlier about some of the modification options for homeowners, but unfortunately, at least in my case, that's never really been a good option.
Have you tried?
Lender is one of the. Oh yes, I have spent hundreds of hours on the phone, faxed hundreds of pages of information, only to have them. For example, I received a letter dated the 25th, thanking me for sending my personal financial information. A letter dated September 1st, requesting two more documents and a letter dated September 2nd saying that they were closing my review because of lack of documentation.
Right. So what do you do about this? So where does it leave you, Amy?
Well, it leaves me very frustrated. My bank has actually gone so far as to make comments. At one point I asked how my child support would count as household income, and the employee had the audacity to make the statement, that money's not for you, it's for your baby.
Okay, but it's in the family pot. That sounds like a tough situation, and it's multiplied again and again. I mean, Chip Case, what's going on here? You know, there's a lot of talk about helping out homeowners in trouble, but are we fundamentally doing that, or are we still fundamentally kind of backstopping the banks? Is that at the expense of homeowners?
It's all the above. You have to look at what happened, and you go back a decade. We created in about 6 years $11 trillion of wealth that didn't exist before. Part of that was new buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that was new buildings, which are real.
That's real.
And the other $5 trillion of that, it was in the value of land. That was easy to put on the books. You had collateral. Collateral had stayed, its value had stayed up for 30 years. We mm-hmm. never had falling house prices nationally mm-hmm. ever for mm-hmm. for 30 years, from mm-hmm. 1975, when you first can find numbers, till now. That led to a lot of confidence. It led to a lot of credit. It was easy to book it. It's hard to take it off. We've got to take off about $6.5 trillion of wealth that was on somebody's books. Much of it's being taken off by the government buying mortgage-backed securities that aren't worth the face value.
Mm-hmm.
The government is now guaranteeing virtually every mortgage that gets written. So it's so difficult to take assets off and decide who really got those losses, because you have sympathy for people for whom there was no fault. You have sympathy for the banks. In some cases you do.
Not a whole lot.
Cases you don't. But it's just the cleaning up the balance sheet and getting the housing market back rolling again are two different goals.
Ivy, how do you see this playing out? Does it play out nationally or does it play out regionally?
Well, I think, you know, Carl made the point that, you know, there's the concentration of the foreclosures are in the top four states. I mean, we say about 65% of the problem is in the top or in 10 states in terms of foreclosures. So there will be markets with the economy hopefully getting better with the GDP comment that Ellen made. You know, we calculate about 2.4% of GDP is residential investment, and that's down from a peak of 6%.
Mm-hmm.
So it really doesn't wag the tail, so to speak, as mm-hmm. much as it may have. And so it is not likely to be a big driver of growth. But let's assume other industries start to show overall improvement. Markets that are not plagued with foreclosures will still have issues about people unable to sell the home at the price they want, or the fact that they're not willing to take on more debt, and they may just stay put, or they don't have any equity and therefore they can't move, but they'll stay there and they'll use it as obviously they'll consume it and continue to live there. So I think the housing market will have markets with dichotomies of performance, but we don't expect a robust recovery even in the markets that aren't plagued by foreclosures, because we have people, I'd say, that are either stuck in their home or choose to stay in their home, and you're going to have depressed turnover until we really see either inflation buy us out of this mess, which could be a long ways away with all the foreclosures as an overhang, but also from just balance sheets that need repair and job growth resuming and overall income growing.
Alan, are we going to see boomers, you know, who can't retire because their homes aren't the piggy bank they hoped? Does that mean good luck for young Americans, families, new grads looking to, you know, get into somewhere to live and own?
You know, I think that's true. I think we're going to raise the retirement age again anyway for the aging Americans. Retirement's an issue. The household sector's financially compromised. We're already, though, there's some silver lining here. This is the fifth year of this process. Maybe, I think, in another 2 or 3 years, depending on macro policy in Washington, what they do this next round,
mm-hmm.
I think that household financial positions will improve, and there'll come a day when, for the fundamental reasons that Carl talked about as to why you should think about buying residential real estate, we'll get more of that demand. And we'll move up, and we'll have a nice move up. It just won't be anywhere near the levels we used to see. We will have worked our way through, I think, legislatively and otherwise, through the write-downs of the mortgages and the balance sheets of financial institutions. we will have figured out a way to do some forgiveness in terms of the monthly payments that households have to make. And, you know, these low interest rates, which the Federal Reserve is guaranteeing us that they will keep, will also be part of that process. So give it another 2 or 3 years, we'll have another conversation, and I think I'll be sounding a lot more positive than I sounded today.
And in the meantime, on the economy, if housing is not going to wag the dog and make the economy give it any bounce, where could it come from? Tell us there's somewhere, Alan, or is there not?
You know, it looks like a low-level, slow growth kind of upturn. The recovery is in place. It's all really all about the consumer. 70% of GDP, and the key fundamentals of the consumer are just not good. Whether it's jobs and not much generation of income, whether it's financial positions having to get real and to get better, take a good deal of time. Asset prices aren't going up enough. The stock market is helping, but that's not enough. And consumers are not confident. And I think Americans just have figured it out. They know that they're kind of left holding the bag. It's a tough environment. It's part of why we see what we're seeing in the political environment. And they're just going to be very careful and cautious. You know, we see them spending a lot of money on leisure and hospitality. The families are taking vacations. Planes are busy. They're just not going to buy cars and houses the way they typically did in most of our recoveries. Too much money. And for houses, the kicker isn't there anymore. And the ability to refinance and pull that money out, as some people have said, like an ATM, doesn't exist. So it's stocks are going to be a better buy than houses.
Oh, boy. And we know what happened there. Alan Sinai, Chief Global Economist and President of Decision Economics. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Thanks.
Ivy Zelman at Zelman & Associates in New York Consulting Group there, focused on the housing industry. Ivy, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom.
Carl, Chip Case, we've just got 20 seconds. What's holding price? Why aren't prices down further?
Because people won't sell. People are notoriously sticky. When they can't get what they think their house is worth, they won't sell. And that's pervasive. In fact, people are backing off now again.
That's where we are right now. Carl, Chip Case, thank you so much for being with us today. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.